in a second-hand set of dimensions, on an astral plane that was never meant to fly, through wavering star mists, see the Greater Tuin. Drifting onwards through space, atop the shell of the world's turtle, are four giant elephants, upon whose broad shoulders rests the Discworld. Welcome to Dining Table Discworld. We're reading through the Discworld novels and discussing them at our dining table. Be aware, there will be spoilers for the current book, and others in the series.
Welcome to Dining Table Discworld. I'm Dave.
I'm Kathy.
And today we are discussing Sorcery by Terry Pratchett. And this is the fifth of the Discworld novels, and it was published in 1988. So, Kathy, what's the synopsis?
In defiance of the law, renegade wizard Ipslaw the Red married and had eight sons. The eighth becomes a source of magic, a sorcerer. Ipslaw evades death to inhabit the staff of his baby son Coin and guide him. While only a child, Coin arrives at the Unseen University, demonstrates his tremendous power, and turns the doddering, backstabbing establishment of wizardry on its head with access to legendary amounts of magic. Sensing danger, Rincewind runs away and encounters a thief with aspirations of hairdressing, a grocer's son with aspirations of barbarian heroism, a pampered ruler with aspirations of poetry, and briefly, a genie with aspirations of a property portfolio. With wizardry tearing itself and reality apart, Rincewind has to confront his inner self and see if he'll stop running and try to prevent the apocalypse. Just as a slight content note, this book does feature an abusive parent, and we will mention that aspect of the story.
Okay, so what are your thoughts on the story?
So, this is the Rincewind book I've read the most, because I think I got it fairly early on, and I'm pretty sure I had it on like a family holiday or something, so I kind of reread it a couple of times, because we had it while I was away. So I think of all the Rincewind books, I've read this one the most times, and some bits of it are still pretty clear to me, and then other bits I hadn't remembered at all. But
yeah, I think this is one I possibly didn't read that much, because I knew one or two bits. I knew there was a sorcerer, and I knew that there was a half brick and a sock.
Yeah.
But much of the in between, I mean, while I was reading it, I was like, oh, I kind of remember this, but I think it's because I'm not a big Wizards fan, and I think I'll come up to my thoughts about the book and the Wizards in a bit.
Sure.
But I mean, you know, as one of the Discworld books goes, it's all right. I don't think it's one I would rave about, but it's
this is why I think it must have been a family holiday. I feel like I read it and I was in a tent.
it gives a tent vibes, doesn't it?
Just that's kind of my vague memory. I mean, I did remember that it had Kanina. I did remember the genie, although I thought that bit was much earlier. Yeah. I remembered, is it Nigel? Nigel,
yeah.
Yeah, and other bits I didn't remember. So I knew that there was like a big war and towers and that, you know, another magic, that, you know, the hat was controlling people and another magic user rose up and they were kind of like warring factions. So I remembered a bit more. I hadn't remembered the Four Horsemen bit, though.
No.
I did kind of remember the apocalypse, but I don't think I got the joke before, which I do get a little more now.
Yeah, no, most of it was like, as I say, when I was reading it, it was like none of it felt new. That we shall move to more in-depth thoughts.
I've got a bit of a thing of like who the people are. I'm quite glad I managed to come up with that format for the synopsis once I've done a couple. So obviously we know Rincewind. He's
Rincewind. He's much the same as he has been in, although now he has an official role within the Unseen University because he's the librarian's assistant.
Yes.
Yes, he is less important than an orangutan.
Well, I mean, I feel like that's very similar to part of your job, so don't put yourself down, sweetheart.
Look.
Yes, I think I'd forgotten how much of the librarian in the library there is as well, actually.
Yeah.
That's a key bit. But yes, so Rincewind meets Kanina, who is a thief. And again, there's that thing where when she's first introduced, it's just the thief moving through the city. And it's so careful to use no pronouns. I'm like, well, this is a woman. So,
I mean, let's be honest, there's no real way to do it in text that doesn't... You can do it in a visual medium easier because...
Yeah, you just have like a mass figure. But I mean, I have seen stuff done in visual stuff as well where they're very carefully not showing you enough of the person. Yes, you're okay. It's going to be a woman.
Yeah, okay.
Or indeed in an A-list plotline where they had the villain no one saw called the man. And I was like, is it going to be a woman? Oh, look, it is. So I'm just saying, the reveal is never it's a bloke, you know?
Yeah, I'm not, yeah, yes, yes.
So she is the daughter of Cohen, who of the barbarian, who obviously Rincewind met in the first couple of books. And there's sort of a thing where she would like to just be a hairdresser.
She wants, but
all her barbarian blood keeps...
Hereditary.
Yes, there's lots of hereditary, which I think a witch explained to her.
Yes.
It doesn't say which one.
No.
And so she's just incredibly good at like fighting to the point where it just sort of seems to happen with little effort. So she's also taken up being
I think this, yeah, it's a, yes, she's a... accidental strong female character insofar as she doesn't want to be
a hairdresser. I'm, could be a strong female character.
I wasn't quite what I was meaning. It was,
or do you mean strong female character TM who can kick ass and look good
but
at
who,
the same time,
you know, doesn't really want the kind of in the Discworld, you know, being a hero is hereditary rather than just something
Something one could pick up from a book, which leads us nicely to Nigel, or Nigel, but clearly originally Nigel, the Destroyer?
The Destroyer, yes.
Who has read a pamphlet or a book on being a barbarian hero and wants to do it. So he's out there in, like, the kind of leather and stuff, but I think he's also wearing long johns because his mum insisted.
Yes, he is, definitely.
And Nigel's just really keen to be a great barbarian warrior, having read... most, but I think not all, of a book about it.
Certainly, it's a how-to guide to barbarian.
Which I think is claimed to be written by Cohen. But
yes.
I'm not sure how literate Cohen was, because I got the impression in Light Fantastic that he didn't have much use for books and probably wasn't particularly literate.
Well, he had an excellent use for... Well, he viewed it as an excellent use for books.
He had nice soft pages.
Exactly.
But yes, so I imagine it's somebody just using his name. And it's interesting, you've got him who's a wannabe barbarian and isn't very good at it. And then you've got Kanina who is good at it without trying. And then they meet and they're both hiding from each other how they really are. So yeah. Kanina's just pretending she's actually, oh, I'm just a hairdresser. And then Nigel's like, oh, I'm a barbarian hero. And then they don't talk. And there's this weird meet-cute moment where they see each other and it's observed through Rincewind, who's like, well... suddenly completely on the side, and I can see the joke, but it's a bit like, oh, okay, like she's a bit like, oh, I just, you know, want him to, well, she says, doesn't she, that some men don't like it if you're stronger than them and better at fighting than them. It's like, well, those guys are rubbish, but the book kind of doesn't say that. And then I think Nigel would be fine with it, but he's trying to prove himself the whole time, but he's not even really hiding so well. He's just not good at it because he's new. So
yes, I think because the thing is, he's only been a barbarian for a few weeks or something like that.
How long was he in the snake pit, though? Like, was a lot of those weeks in the snake pit?
Possibly.
So I think it's supposed to be sort of cute and funny, but it's not. I think I didn't find it as cute and funny as I think I was supposed to.
No, I agree. It is. You could definitely see where it was supposed to be going. It's very obvious them getting together in the end in some regard, but it doesn't quite feel... Is it again Pratchett and his romances?
I guess kind of. I don't think it's even that. I think it's just, it's a little... like, I can see what he's doing, you know. She's a barbarian hero pretending not to be. He wants to be one. Isn't very good at it. They should have a lot in common, but they're like hiding each other's real life from each other. I mean, you see this in rom-coms and things quite a bit, but I think it's because it feels a bit sort of to the side of things, because they sort of have the moment. It's very clear, oh, here's the spark or the zing or this moment. Yeah. And then each of them sort of seems to confide in Rincewind a little bit about it. Oh, don't let on how I, you know, who I really am or what I really like. And Rincewind's just there, but like, what? But then other stuff feels a bit more like it's not about their relationship, and it kind of gets pushed aside enough.
Well, yes,
it feels like an afterthought a little bit.
They're kind of the minor characters that,
yeah, I think I've had times put on them, but yeah, I think it's fine. It's just not it's not as strong as I think other books are. Even like, because Rincewind usually finds some people to travel about with.
Yeah. But.
So speaking of, then the other person they encounter is Creosote, who is of the phrase "rich as Creosote."
Yes.
Which is obviously a reference to "rich as Croesus." Croesus being the king of Lydia from 585 BC until his country was conquered by Cyrus the Great, a Persian leader. But I mean, basically, this is 2,500 years ago.
Yeah.
In fact, Creosote's kind of an amalgamation of various kind of mythical or literary Middle Eastern kings or Eastern kings.
Yeah.
Because he's also got, like, these big pleasure gardens, and he's trying to write poetry, and so that's obviously a lot like Coleridge's poem, Kubla Khan. And again, he's, if anything, probably even more one-note than Nigel and Kanina.
Yes, I mean, he's obviously, you know, he appears to be some sort of womanizer, you know, or interested in... Not womanizer, but, you know,
Well, he's a seraph, he's the ruler.
Yeah, but interesting. So
and in a culture where harems are a thing people have.
Yes, yes, but all he wants to do is listen to stories.
Yeah.
Which
is obviously, the reference to Scheherazade and the Arabian Nights.
You know, he's set up as this, you know, so, you know, you think, oh, you know, he's going to... And he's like, actually, no, he's just slight...
Well, so he's the ruler of Klatch, which is mentioned more in later books... but is very much just kind of Middle East and various bits of Asia.
Middle East, India, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of Middle East, Indian subcontinent.
Yeah, because you've got the temple when they first arrive on the boat, and there's the big temple, which is very much an Indian style temple with various people cavorting on it.
And I think later it's, in later books, it's a kind of more Indian subcontinent, but... Yeah. But then again, like, Kublai Khan, although it's got that name, that's actually, because that's based on Marco Polo, so that's actually even further east. And yes, he's really into poetry, but he's just a figurehead. It's all being run by the vizier, who's a magic user. And he's just a figurehead who's kind of, like, you know, kept in the pleasure gardens, and he's got all these women around, because it's a harem. But then, yeah, as you say, he just wants stories. And his thing is sort of that he is a poet, and he's desperately into poetry, but he's not very good at it. No, it's almost like he can... see the shapes of it, but he can't actually write it down.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting idea of a frustrated artist.
Yeah.
I think that would be more interesting if he wasn't just a bit objectionable, because he's obviously this pampered person. And again, I think that's a bit of a Middle Eastern thing. There are various like rulers who were just kind of kept away from the world and just pampered in one place because they're from the right family. And again, he's incredibly rich, so it's sort of a bit like you don't feel bad for him. And then he keeps... Like, the way he talks to Kanina, he keeps describing bits of her body, and you're like...
Yeah, that's a bit,
and it's supposed to be poetic, but you're a bit like, mm. She seems to kind of not mind or mostly ignore it, so... Mm. So, yeah, you don't really feel for him too much. And then at the end, when everything else gets kind of put back, he's sort of, like, talking to a barmaid, but she's just impressed with the flowery language, and he's impressed that she can tell a load of stories.
Yeah.
So I guess that's nice for him.
I suppose you're in a position there, it's obviously... when we first meet him, he is in his pleasure gardens and is, you know, surrounded by stuff. You know, he ends the story in the mended drum, which is a very different kind of environment for him, which, you know.
Yes.
I think he'll land on his feet somehow.
Yeah, but I know it's hard to say how, because he has no experience of the outside world. He's just been pampered the whole time and now he doesn't have any money. But yeah, it's a bit of an odd one, that. It feels a bit like Pratchett kind of stuck in a few too many... what would be sidekicky characters or like a more of a group thing, but the group didn't cohere very well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could have taken him out and not really, or at least you had him there, but not kind of join the party.
He could have just been left in the palace.
Yeah.
I kind of half forgot he was travelling with them.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair enough. He's not really, like, he doesn't really add anything to the...
I remember the genie thing better. Although that was only a brief scene, I thought Genie was there for longer. And that's mostly because of the thing where they're inside the lamp, but they're carrying the lamp that they're inside. And you mustn't think too much about it, because otherwise the gods or physics will notice and get upset.
Reality takes a hold and goes, nope.
Yeah, because then Nigel is holding the lamp and he shakes it and it shakes. And I kind of remember that bit. I didn't remember that the Genie is very obviously a yuppie.
Yes.
Probably because I didn't have much context for such a thing. Not then.
But yes, very much. Yes, he has all these various bits of property that he's trying to.
Well, it's magical property though. Yes. So he's got several lamps he's working on, and he's looking to get, you know, some in better locations. And a ring, I think, as well, yeah. Which is obviously then the Aladdin reference. And yes, it's the fact that he's like doing like answer phone stuff and like call center type stuff that now is very normal, but I think was newish back then.
Well,
I think it was very business. Oh, it's very businessy.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a bit of a, you know.
I mean, to be fair, at 88, I wasn't interacting with that kind of thing, but I can certainly...
Well, no, me neither, but I get the impression that sort of thing, phones used to be answered more by people, and it was less... So the fact that he's got automated is kind of a bit... Like, even the idea of him... Because at one point he's talking to something that's clearly supposed to be analogue for a mobile phone, but yes. I think at that point in the 80s, only business people had those.
They were quite large bricks.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, the genie's all right as a little aside.
It feels like creosote could have been that. Because the joke is that the phrase is rich as Croesus, and the way that's spelled, it does look a little like creosote, so they've called him creosote.
Yeah.
Which obviously here in Round World is, you know, preservative for timber.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you could have definitely just left him, I mean, possibly not in the Pleasure Gardens, given what happens to that area of Clatch, but, you know... I mean, we don't go into the loss of life that must have happened due to the wizard war, but, you know.
Well, that's the whole thing, because reality is basically tearing itself apart. So you've got Coin, who's turned up. Well, did you want to keep going
with your list? Yeah, that's
well, a... I think that was the main ones of the people who were with Rincewind.
Yeah. Oh, and the luggage.
Yes, true, the luggage. I mean, the luggage is a little bit odd, because Rincewind sort of, like, has a crush on Kanina.
Yeah, that's a bit...
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things where if you look at the front cover, it's actually hard to tell exactly how scantily clad she is. Very much so. Everything's pink. She's got something. I can't tell how much of a bikini cup that actually is or how much it's just decorative.
Decorative.
Yeah. Whereas in the book, you get the impression she's actually dressed quite sensibly, but then is just fighting and stuff. But yeah, so Rincewind's got kind of a crush on her, and then when she meets Nigel, he sort of puts that out of his mind. And again, maybe it's just because she's a pretty lady who's been travelling with him.
Well, but I think the thing is, the luggage has a bit of a crush on her.
The luggage has a crush, and she doesn't like it because it's weird.
Well, I think she doesn't quite understand. I mean,
she kicks it and yells at it and glares at it a bit, and then rather than it snapping back, it just gets sad and wanders into the desert.
Well, I think the thing is, I mean... I think Rincewind gets annoyed with the luggage because the luggage stops doing what he wants it to do and just kind of does what...
It doesn't even do what she... What she wants to do is to leave her alone and stop... It's trailing around after her, bumping into her, so she kicks it and yells at it.
The thing is, Rincewind gets annoyed because it's no longer kind of doing his stuff.
I do feel like the luggage feels like a bigger thing in this. It sort of seems to be out of it for quite a lot of the time.
It does.
I think the librarian's a bigger part, but we can get into that with the wizard.
But I think in some respects, this gives it starts to build on its personality.
I don't know. This felt different to luggage's personality. It seemed like it just got all kind of like puppy-eyed and
It's a piece of walking luggage. Who knows? But anyway. So yes, who's next on your list?
Oh, that was.
Okay, that was the only list you had.
Well, I mean, I've written wizard stuff, but you want to talk about wizard stuff.
Okay, that's fine.
General wizard stuff.
That's fine, that's all right.
Yeah.
Wizards, yes. So this is the last book before wizards actually become interesting, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, okay.
Well, see,
I thought you said you generally didn't like wizards.
I generally didn't like wizards, but I like the Ridcully, you know...
It sort of settles.
Yeah, it settles. It, you know, suddenly it becomes... You actually get some... interesting consistent characters, because with the exception of Rincewind and the librarian, there have been no consistent wizard characters.
That's true.
You know, we've got a new, they're electing a new arch-chancellor, we've got a, you know, kind of new, you know, cast of wizards, which, yeah, there's been no continuity through, you know, and again, it's a different style of, we've gone from smoking boots promotions in, and still it's mentioned a bit in here, smoking boots promotions.
Oh, no, it's definitely still kind of backstabby, but it's going more towards the kind of slightly rubbish dinners. Academia, which was kind of more what you had in Equal Rights, really, because Equal Rights didn't go into the backstabby bit, the kind of like stuffy academia, and this seems to be a bit of both.
But I think, you know, obviously, you know, in story wise, when Ridcully becomes Arch-Chancellor, he gets rid of the whole backstabby bit, and
we'll get to that.
Yeah, but you know, it becomes a bit more interesting. You've got Hex and all of that stuff, which is you know I find fun. So this is the last book of, you know, where it is kind of less And yes, you don't actually, none of these characters you'll see going forward.
I mean, there's Carding and Spelter, who are the kind of main two wizards you see through the point of view. Was it, one's the bursar?
Yes.
And one's just another high-up wizard. And when Coin turns up, they kind of are quite instrumental in, like, getting him to be, like, well, doing the official arts chants a bit, but then they start feeling, having reservations about it, feeling worried.
Well, I think it's things like when so Coin is the sorcerer. He's the eighth son of an eighth son.
Of an eighth son. Because it's magic squared.
Yes.
A source of magic. That's the joke.
Yes. But also this is why they say wizards can't have personal relationships or children. Well, basically, this is why wizards can't have sex, is because they want to avoid sorcerers happening.
Wizards should just be careful.
Well, yes, that would, you know...
Also, that's speak not, to the not, witches. It's not all sex. Some must be fine. It's a very monastic environment, is all I'm saying. Anyway.
Yes, but it says in the book that about...
Well, there's a lot of stuff about the law.
Yes, and that's
there?
L-O-R-E, not...
Yes.
So, but they, you know, it says... That is the reason they don't, because sorcerers caused the mage wars in the past, which caused massive amount of damage. And
then you sort of see what I think is probably a brief version of that in this.
Yeah.
Well, there's also, what you think about in more, the whole thing is that, oh, if wizards are feeling too kind of lustful, that interferes with the magic, yeah. Which doesn't seem to be what's happened with Ipslaw. So I think it kind of jumps around a little bit reason.
Yeah, I think as a reason, this one kind of makes as much sense as anything. I can certainly see seeing the damage a sorcerer can do.
Yeah.
You would want to try and avoid them cropping up.
Yeah, because what happens is Coin is just a kid. He's like, I'm not quite sure how old he is, but he's young.
We're saying preteen, yeah, but you know,
I mean, could be even younger, really. And he turns up and he just brings all this magic with him to the point where the wizard suddenly can do everything that they couldn't do before. The limits of wizardry weren't quite clear, but it's obvious there has to be a certain level of study and learning and all of that. And suddenly they can just do all this stuff, and then it goes immediately to their heads, and they're incredibly tyrannical almost from the off.
Well, I think it's... Well, Coin starts suggesting, why are not wizards not controlling things? Why we are the most powerful, so... Yes. Although how much of that is Coin and how much of that is stuff,
I think we'll get into that in a separate bit.
Yeah, but, you know, they start...
Well, this is also the book where we first meet Vesinari.
Yes.
As Patrician of Ankh-Morpork, and definitely Vesinari, because before, when we've seen a patrician, we didn't think it was Vesinari.
No, a few of them have been named. A couple of them were named, but they weren't.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The names of various ones. And it also mentions, like in Mort, there's like the Patrician's Palace, but that didn't seem like a Vesinari type event.
No.
But this is definitely Vesinari, and he does seem to be very much himself for the brief time he's there before he is turned into a lizard and put in a jar.
Yeah.
But what I had forgotten is that Waffles was there.
Waffles.
So soon.
Waffles the dog.
I kind of picture him as a little, one of those little, those white little dogs. Is it Yorkshire Terrier?
No, Westies.
West Highland Terrier. There you go. I knew it was a terrier that was named after a place.
Yes.
But the little white ones, like on those dog food adverts, I kind of picture him being like that, but like a bit old and wheezy.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, in fairness, I grew up with a small white dog that was old and wheezy, although she was a mongrel. But yes, yeah. It's that Waffles is obviously very old and is said to be the only thing the patrician loves. And I know he comes up more in like later books, which is where I remembered it. And I was like, oh, Waffles is there. So that's kind of nice, I guess. But yes, the patrician's there, the wizard summoned him, he's like, what are you doing? Because he's used to them being just these sort of silly old duffers.
Yeah.
Or, well, they're probably a little bit dangerous, but just to each other. I think that's the thing, wizards were kind of contained and they were a problem to each other.
Yes, they were inside the walls of the university, it was like, yes, there was some magic spillover, but it was a certain amount of, okay, that's fine.
And then they just turn up and turn everything to glass and marble and shininess and everything is swept away and then all the people, and then they go out into the street and somebody offers them food and he just creates a perfect pie from nowhere and, you know, people are being destroyed and everything's awful and this guy runs away going, they've gotten rid of his living.
Yeah.
So it's all a bit, they've just, yeah, so Ankh-Morpork's kind of in the centre of one thing and then the Arch-Chancellor's hat, which is a talking hat who seems to decide a lot of stuff, but like from 88, So yeah. Not like another talking hat size thing.
No. This one is considerably...
It's very ruthless because it's got... Well, because it's been sitting on the heads of the rulers of magic for about 2,000 years. And it's still the kind of very backstabby sort of like dead man's boots kind of thing. So it's kind of, I think, absorbed that as a magical like symbol of, you know, leadership. And so then it basically tells Kanina psychically to steal it and then talks to Rincewind and Kanina in their heads to take it to a magic user. And so that's why they get the clash, because then the Creosote's Grand Vizier is, you know, kind of becomes... So you've sort of got sorcery fighting wizardry, but I think it's kind of wizardry plus.
Yes.
Because the hat is doing it.
That the hat takes over the vizier and basically, and you know, and there's towers because wizards have towers, and that's a whole thing about the mage wars.
And, yeah. And also a reference to the two towers.
Yes.
Like wizard towers.
Yes. Yes,
that's the thing.
Yeah. So yes, the wizards, you know, do kind of come out and be, you know, and they try and burn, well, they do burn the library down, but not, the books are not in there, but...
Yes. Yeah, so,
very aggrieved about that.
Yeah, because because he's trying to sweep everything away, and then the librarian...
Because he coins the source of magic, you don't need the books anymore. The books of magic are no longer necessary.
And then some wizards are sent to do it, and some of them seem to be a bit uneasy about it, and then the librarian kind of gets them. But yes, the librarian... It's when Rincewind... I'd forgotten this bit. It's when Rincewind discovers the librarian and all the books are hiding with the patrician as a lizard and Waffles in the Tower of Art.
Which I think the implication being one of the original towers from the Mage Wars.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yes.
Just about staying standing. So yes. And then you've got the idea of this part, these books that, you know, that are, you know, like refugee books that, you know, they're magic books. They've flown out of the, you know, and there's been some losses and...
It's time to fix them. There's a lot of, book fixing, isn't there?
Yes, amputations and things, you know. Or appendectomies.
Yes. I can't remember quite how that's spelled, but that is the joke.
Yes.
Yes, so. Yes, the librarian's just trying to guard them all and keep, I guess, his charges safe. And in some respects, I think librarians sort of struggling to keep books safe is something of a theme. Now, maybe not so much here, but in some parts of the world.
Unfortunately.
But yes, a little bit more literal and magical and with an orangutan.
Yes, you know, so the wizards are there. You know, they are trying to take over the world, and you obviously have a bit of a fight with the hat and rewrite reality in various ways.
I think
they can.
Yeah. There's also a lot of stuff about what wizardry is and what is a wizard. And that largely is what relates to Rincewind.
Yeah.
Or did we actually think about it? There's some other stuff that kind of goes to the end. I think there's other stuff we wanted to talk about a bit first.
Do we want to talk about the anthropomorphic personifications?
I was going to talk about the inspiration particles.
Go on.
So this is the book. And I've forgotten it was this one until I read it again. But I think that's why this was so clear in my head, which has the idea of the inspiration particles. So the idea is that there's inspiration sleeting through the universe and it hits the right person at the right time. So Creosote's kind of example of this, that he can kind of, you know, all these wonderful ideas for epic poems, and then it references various ones in our world, sort of hit him, but he doesn't have the poetic ability to write them. Yeah. And then there's the thing about how, you know, it's tragic if they hit the wrong target. So, for example, a bewildered duck has an inspiration about cheap, clean energy, but it's a duck, it can't do anything with it. So it's kind of one of these side things, but, you know, it hits the right person at the right time and suddenly they think, you know, have this eureka moment. It kind of foreshadows that Rincewind, there's a particle sleeting through the multiverse, the dimensions, which is heading towards Rincewind, and will he be at the right place to catch it, which kind of foreshadows what happens later on. But that's quite an interesting thing that I've, you know, is a Discord idea that I've forgotten was from this particular book. Also, I feel like there's some quite good language in there as well. I mean, they all have some good bits, but this has some quite good phrases I noted down. So there was the thing with the cholesterol of silence that had the heart of the city in its grip.
Yeah.
After the wizards sort of take over. Because, again, there's the idea of quiet isn't the opposite of noise. There's like a silence that's loud.
Yeah.
It's a practice of things about things going like past what their normal opposite to the other side. There's also something that's actually recently done. There's an account on Blue Sky called Rincewind.run. Which does Discord quote of the day. Fairly recently, their one from Sorcery, This is describing what happens when wild magic just like hits things and goes awry.
Oh, yes, so yes, that's it.
It was quite impossible to describe. Here is what it looked like. It looked like a piano sound shortly after being dropped down a well. It tasted yellow, and it felt paisley. It smelt like the total eclipse of the moon.
Yeah, that's reality going.
and it just shows what you can do with prose and what Pratchett can do with prose. Because, I mean, you couldn't film that. And this is the thing, some people said, yeah, this is why a lot of this is kind of unfilmable, because there's so many bits and side bits, and you can do some stuff with that, but you can't, like, you can only describe this in words to try and, you know, sort of mix it up. So that's kind of cool. And I think, you know, there's sort of more and more of that. I think what I was wondering is, did you have any thoughts on Ipslaw and Rincewind and kind of how they are as two characters?
I mean, one's in it more than the other. okay, so Ipslaw is the eighth son of an eighth son, so he is a powerful wizard in his own right.
Well, I don't know if being the eighth son of an eighth son makes you powerful. It actually makes you a wizard, but he is himself very powerful and talented.
Well, he does say that he was a powerful...
I don't know if that was because of the ape something.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah.
I feel like they don't. Or really, don't really nail that down. But...
All of his sons.
Okay. I think it's more that what occurred to me is Ipslaw is kind of like a dark mirror of Rincewind.
Yes.
So they're both kind of runaway wizards, but in a very different way, because Ipslaw decides that the institution and the law of wizardry is holding him back. No, he's not going to settle for that. And I mean, it says he falls in love, but there's really nothing about his wife who's dead at the start of the book. So, he decided he was going to do what he wanted to do rather than it being some sort of grand love. You know, so he gets married, and he leaves wizardry behind, and he gets married. But it's not like he's living quietly. He has these seven sons. They're all powerful wizards. Nothing about what they do, except that he said they wouldn't listen to him. And it's like, if seven of your kids won't listen to you and seem to be no contact, as far as I can tell, I don't think you're a great parent.
There's a Reddit post here. So.
Yes. And then he has the eighth one. So the impression is that his wife dies in childbirth with Coin. Coin is just a baby. And Ipsil's talking to Death, and basically he cheats Death by going into his staff and giving it to Coin. So his power's passed on, but also he's inhabiting it. But the whole point is he basically says he wants to make sure Coin does what he wants him to do. Yeah. So he's obviously a very controlling person and very entitled.
I would say so controlling, he declares Coin's destiny.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get much more controlling than basically saying this is what you
this
will
is what
be.
You do, baby.
Yeah, you know, this is your future.
Yeah, and I mean the fact that Coin, I mean, we'll get into the nastiness of it, but it just gives me that Ipslaw, you know, he's decided he's better than wizardry. He's rejected the constraints of wizardry despite being very talented and presumably quite high up at the university, and then he wants to tear wizardry down. Yeah. I'm too good for this. I don't like... It's not like, oh, he fell in love and, oh, this doesn't work for me anymore, like leaving the, you know, clergy or something, or the monastery. It's that he's, no, I'm going to go back and tear it all down and make it in my image. It's how I want to be. He's incredibly entitled. Yeah. So he's incredibly powerful, but incredibly entitled, and he almost brings wizardry down. Then you've got Rincewind, who's a runaway wizard in that he's a wizard who runs away a lot because he's scared.
Scared of everything.
Also, the whole thing is that Rincewind is a terrible wizard. He's not even level one.
No, he's. I mean, this is Rincewind without the book of the creator spell in his head, scaring all the other spells away. This is Rincewind.
Yes, he's not got the Tarbo in there anymore.
Who's simply has zero magical ability. You know.
And this is the thing, it's that Rincewind is the opposite. Yeah, he's an awful wizard. He can't do hardly anything.
I don't know. But I think he's the best wizard. He's just magically inept.
Yeah, but no, this is the point. It gets to the heart of what wizardry is, which I think Carding and Spelter, who are sort of around Coin, start to kind of realise, and I think the ones who are uneasy about the books realise. Like, Rincewind won't get rid of his hat. Like, being a wizard is a bad thing now because they're kind of destroying everything, but Rincewind won't get rid of his hat. His hat says wizard. It's not spelled correct. I think at one point he says, you know what this hat means? It's like that you can't spell.
Yeah.
I think Chris actually said to make snarky comments, but, like, Kalina can also do that. Yeah. So, again, he doesn't seem super useful. But, yeah, it's... And Rincewind... This thing, Rincewind runs because it's dangerous. And, in fact, he runs before Coin even shows up because the university has a premonition. The bedbugs are running. The rats are running.
He's a wizard that is so in tune with the university that he can tell when the university is scared.
But then he runs.
Yeah, no, yeah, but the other point is, you've got all of these, you know, powerful four wizards there that are completely oblivious.
They're having a big dinner.
They're having a big dinner, true. And they are waiting to hat the latest Arch-Chancellor. But yes, you know, he's so in tune with it, you know, he sees all these signs and goes, I'm out of here.
Yeah, so... And then he kind of
goes to the bar.
In the end, he gets picked up by the hat, so a bit. But the point is that Rincewind, at his core, is a wizard. He may not be any good at doing magic, but at his core, he is a wizard, and he wants to protect wizardry.
Yes.
And in fact, this is the whole core of... When the others are sort of saying about how bad is the wizard and stuff, and he goes back. And I think he's slightly entranced, but I think this is one thing. He looks inside himself and goes, I always run, I try and save myself. And he goes, but I must protect this, because without wizardry... What am I? That is what I am.
Yeah.
Despite obvious inability to do magic. So even though he's the lowest of the low and terribly untalented, wizardry means so much to him. You know, because I feel like if Rincewind had sort of given up being a wizard and gone and just lived a regular life and ate more pork and, I don't know, got married or just worked as a translator or something, you know, like I don't think the universe would be like, all right, fine, fair enough. They hardly remember him, particularly, I guess, this lot, because it's all changeable. But you know, he goes back and he sort of sacrificed himself, which is not what you think he'd do. And he goes in with no plan and very little ability to just try and save the only institution, the only place he thinks he belongs, because he is a wizard. Even if he's a terrible wizard, he is a wizard. And I think that's sort of, you know, where you've got, you know, Ipsil's the antagonist, Rincewind's the protagonist, although they don't really meet that much. But it's this kind of like dark mirror of that, you know.
Yes.
One of them's cast it aside and is taking everything over, and the other one's like clinging desperately to this thing that he's no good at. But it is his identity.
But he does wield a half brick and a sock very well.
Yes, this is the thing. Rincewind's about to go up against a sorcerer. He has no idea what to do. He just knows he has to try and save stuff. It's in the books are safe, at least. And then he goes into this incredibly dangerous place, and he has a half brick in a sock, because when he was a kid in Animal Pork, that was the thing you could use in alleyway. And that's when we get into the whole coin and Ipsil thing now. Ipsil's abusing his son. Like, that's just what's happening. He's controlled him his whole life. He's, you know, as you say, he decided his destiny, but he's made sure that Coin does everything he's supposed to do. And I mean, there's a bit when carding spells while they're still at the university, kind of hear him sobbing in the night, like proper, he's a crying child. And obviously the wizards don't know what to do with that, because they're just
useless.
And the prospect of, you know, and they've been having this massive wizard's duel across two continents, and that's been fine. And then Rincewind shows up with a half brick and a sock. And Coin laughs, and suddenly he's like a kid. And he's like, oh, no, this guy's funny. What was it?
He's like, looks like a rabbit,
He's like, he's harmless, like he's an angry rabbit.
Yeah.
And at that moment, Coin is laughing, and his weird metal staff that has the ghost of his father in it suddenly tells him off. And his reason says, you know, you know what bad boys get. And it's, you know, and it's clear this poor kid has been certainly emotionally neglected and emotionally abused, probably physically as well, because it seems like it can administer shock. So that's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, given
nasty stuff.
You know, he's not, you know, 8, potentially. I mean, again to age-wise, it's very
difficult.
It's
somewhere between 6 and 11.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, still
You know, you don't really know how he's grown up, but you presume he's just...
He's not his mother around, obviously.
No, what sort of him, you know, some sort of caregiver and the staff.
Is there even a caregiver? He'd probably just magic up food.
I think when he was a baby, perhaps.
It's not clear. But the point is, it's going to have been grim.
Yeah. The point is, it's not going to be a nice childhood of any description.
I don't think it was even a childhood. I think it was just like a terrible guy in a metal stick.
As soon as he became
crafting
old,
a child,
old enough to become
power source,
old enough to kind of understand things. So I think he's more likely to be sort of 8 to 10 kind of age, because I mean,
it's hard to say.
Yeah, but you know, you've got to get him old enough to be able to start to understand to do what some of the things that he wanted.
Well, yeah, but the point is,
it doesn't matter really. It's sucked for Coin.
Yes, that's pretty nasty. And then also the fact that at the very end, Coin and Rincewind get sucked into the dungeon dimensions, because that's still a reoccurring thing. And they're there facing all these kind of faceless horrors. And at that point, there's just sand. So Rincewind fills his half sock with sand as the only thing's around. And then Yeah, this is where Rincewind is, like, brave and courageous, which is obviously so against his usual personality and all he's been built up to be. But he doesn't feel he has a choice, because if Wizardry is gone, he's nothing, like, in his own self. And there's a lot of stuff where Rincewind, like, talks to himself and, like, his conscience says something. And
yes.
His libido says something a bit, and it's a bit like, go away. And
yeah.
So there's a lot of him, like, talking to himself, sort of quite literalized internal monologue. But the fact is, at one point, he's holding off these, like, creepy, gribbly monster things, and he's telling Coin to get out. And,
well, because he knows...
Because there's a portal. But what Rincewind has to do, because he heard what Ipsil was like, he heard the staff, and did it zap him as well?
Yeah, I think...
Yeah, it kind of electrocutes him a bit. But Coin's so shocked he won't move, because now Coin's... Because that's after he's thrown the staff away, so...
He's throwing the staff away, and...
So his father's actually been...
Death has been collected to him.
Yes.
Because the destiny was that basically nothing...
Ipsil couldn't be taken until Coin threw away his staff.
Yeah.
But Ipsil was like, oh, a wizard would never throw away his staff. And it's like, well, if you're horrible enough, then he is going to go no contact. I'm sorry. But it's that in order to get Coin to move, Rincewind, who's seen what this like, actually has to kind of quote Ipsil. He has to say, because Coin's frozen, the only way to snap out is just go, oh, you know what bad boys get.
Yeah.
To use the, you know, abusive words his father's been using to kind of shake him into obeying him so that he can save himself.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, Rincewind's basically lost in the dungeon dimensions.
Yes.
And it's not clear that he's definitely dead, but it sort of seems like...
Well,
that's it for Rincewind, but like time's all weird there, and
he doesn't get out of the portal when it closes.
He's fighting, and yeah, the thing. Well, that's the point. He makes sure Coin gets out.
Because the thing is, because the whole point was if the creatures from the dungeon dimensions got a sorcerer, you know, then it would be bad news for
everything.
But Rincewind, he's got no magical ability, so
yeah. And part of me feels like if it ended there, it'd be like, oh, well, that, you know, like Rincewind's. Yeah. Run as much as he can run, and then he's turned around and taken his stand, and oh no, poor Rincewind.
Yeah.
But yes, I don't remember which one is the next Rincewind book, but I guess that's
Is it Eric?
I guess it would be, wouldn't it?
I think that's quite early, isn't it? And then he gets, because he... Yes, it's after Guards, so he gets summoned back.
Well, okay. But yeah, I know. I kind of felt like this was almost writing an end to Rincewind, because I know Pratchett himself had said at some point that Rincewind was not always the most interesting character to write, because he just had to run away, and you had to get him to run away and then find something to get him to turn around,
yeah.
I guess. So, but yeah, if it had been a go out, it would have been quite a noble sort of one. Did you want to talk about the anthropomorphic?
We once again see the four horsemen, because they are gathering for the apocalypse.
So again, I didn't get the joke at first. So it's the apocalypse, but then Rincewind said it's called the apocalypse because all the writings about it were seen thought to be apocryphal.
Yeah.
So that's the joke.
Yeah. So they've gathered in a bar. To basically ride forth, and in some respects, Koinina, Nigel, and Creosote do Stymon, you know, stop the apocalypse end of the world a little bit by stealing three of the four horses.
But the ice giants are still riding on their massive glacier cows.
Although we do see them getting drunk, which obviously previously we've. Death doesn't get drunk, so obviously...
Well, no, because Death leaves, because he has to go to Ipsil.
Yeah,
so it's just war and pestilence, and famine is there, but doesn't say anything.
Yeah, but then they do end up getting drunk.
So they don't realise their horses have been stolen from it. And then the others are... So Rincewind's gone off to do his thing, and then the other three, who again, I feel like, not the best secondary characters, but they're going to do what they can to stop it. So Nigel has his moment of, no, I'm still going to do something, and... So they steal these horses, which turn out to fly, and then they're all a bit freaked out about that. And then they fly into the face of the ice giants, who are giant, and are riding glaciers, which I think are also like cows.
Something like that, yeah.
It's sort of like herding, but it's also quite Scandinavian.
Yeah. And cold.
So maybe more like reindeer then. But yeah, it's that they're... And Nigel's like, could you just not destroy the world? And they're like, no, we want to. We like it to be cold now.
Yeah.
So
it's because Coin has banished the gods.
And the gods were keeping the ice giants locked in.
And because what else do you do when you've become, you know, got control of the world? You banish the gods. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's fun to see the four horsemen around.
Yeah, but again, it kind of only happens because Corin restores things. So it feels like they went for this big thing and theirs didn't really do anything, whereas Rincewind's did a bit.
I
feel like, because I read that bit, I don't remember this at all, and I feel like it just basically got overwritten when I read Good Omens.
That's fair.
If I'm honest. And then also probably later in Thief of Time.
I think they just crop up. Again, that bit.
I think that's the next time they crop up, really, which is a while. So, yeah.
Obviously, death's around.
Well, yeah. But I mean the other horseman. Yeah. And I mean, I don't think Famine says anything. They're just sort of implying he's there eating.
Yeah.
But it's mostly war and pestilence talking to each other. But yeah, they're not super strong in that. And I've just been reminded of the other thing, which is the geese.
Geese.
So there's an on-rain joke that Nigel has misread the... I'm not sure how to say it, because of course I've only read it. It was like geese. And it sounds a bit like geese, and there's this joke about isn't that a kind of bird?
Yeah.
But it's, you know, the idea that one has to, follow a quest or... Yeah. Something. I feel like it was in a Diamond Jones book as well.
Yes, usually magical compulsion.
Yes, that's it. And then at the end, there's a weird little bit about, here are some funny looking birds. They're called geese. And it's like, I thought it was just a joke on geese. But yeah. So, but yes, because every so often Nigel says, he's got his geese. And someone's like, I think he's bothered by his birds or something. So yeah, there's odd little bits.
So let's wrap this up.
Yeah.
I think, as the core, there's some interesting bits of story here.
Yeah. There's some, I think some of the central stuff's quite strong.
Yeah.
I think making wizardry be terrible and all that, I guess it goes down to its knees and then presumably gets a bit controlled later, makes sense.
Yeah.
I think giving Rincewind something that's at the core of him to act, rather than him just running away from stuff and running into worse stuff and having to escape it, actually giving him something to fight for more. It's good. I can see the incident with Kanina, the other side characters, less so, but...
Yeah.
Like, again, it's fine.
I think if you like the wizard stuff...
If you like Rincewind...
I think if you like the early wizard stuff, then this is fine.
Yeah.
If you like the later wizard stuff, I think this...
You can sort of see the flickerings of it, I guess.
Yeah.
I think it's mostly what has to happen for that to turn up.
Yeah. I think, obviously, because you have to presume Ridley is somewhere...
I think it was mentioned later, I can't remember.
Yes, but the point is he's got to have been somewhere there because he's a powerful wizard, within the...
Yeah.
To take over.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to the discussion of timelines within Pratchett when we get to Thief of Time.
I mean, there is a bit in this that says that... we know at this point that the university got founded 2,000 years ago by Albert, fair enough. But then it says the King's of Ankh-Morpork were 2,000 years ago. I'm like, no, I'm sorry, that doesn't make any sense as a timeline because of stuff that happens in the Watch books. And also that somebody can trace a character can trace their lineage back to the Regicide. It's like, well, it's not going to be 2,000 years then, is it? It's going to be some centuries. So that is something where I feel like it was said and then it kind of like quietly revised later on when there was more continuity.
Yeah.
Which is fair enough.
I think almost this is... Would you say this is the last book where continuity almost doesn't matter?
Well, I don't think that's quite true, because I think Pratchett did what he did. Like the coincidence that Nanny Ogg names 12 kids and that's how many shouts is a coincidence. But I think it's the... I think a lot more ensemble stuff comes up later and a lot of the settings and the sub-series get more bedded in. I think that's where you do have to have a bit more
the previous ones, they're all relatively standalone. Mm-hmm. And yes, you have some of the themes that carry through, but less of the...
Yeah, I mean, you can have a city-state pining for the old way of doing things for some centuries, but we are not now very worried about whether the Roman Republic's going to come back, let's face it, And I mean, even now...
I am, definitely. I'm very nervous about the Roman Republic coming back.
Oh, no, they wanted it to come back. It was a whole thing. They had kings, and they had a republic, and then they had the whole imperial thing, but they kept pretending it was really going to be the Republic any time.
Okay.
And if you look at here, like when we had the Civil War and the Regicide and stuff, it's like... Probably there are people who can trace their descendants from Oliver Cromwell, but it's not really much of a thing we're thinking about.
No.
I suppose that got reversed quite quickly. But yeah, it's sort of a bit like, we don't have kings anymore, we've got a different system. And people do hark back to it for a while, but it's only some centuries. It's not too millennia.
No.
But anyway, that's just the thing I know. So I was like, that wouldn't make any sense.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, obviously the next book we're going to be doing is kind of a... a linchpin that starts a whole branch of sorcery is the last of the kind of ones that kind of sit in its own little thing of...
Yeah, I could see that.
You know, whereas, you know, as I said, in Mort, that it's like, you can start at Mort for the Death series, but it's almost better to start a Reaper Man.
Well, no, I think starting Mort is fine.
But I still don't think it's quite...
I'd say it's more like you'd start a Weird Sisters for Witches, you wouldn't start Equal Right. I mean, I did, but I wouldn't advise it.
I mean,
this, obviously it follows, I mean, Rincewind follows on from, like, you know, the first two books, but you don't, other than Kanina being mentioned, because I read this before I read A Colour of Magic and Light Fantastic, and it was fine. Kanina's dad is a barbarian hero who Rincewind has met. That's all you need to know. Done. You know?
Yeah, I'm just thinking that perhaps, when we get to Eric, we'll find Rincewind, that's more of the Rincewind that we follow through, because he does start...
I don't feel like I remember a lot of the other Rincewind books. No, I've got to say,
it's...
So I think we'll see how we go with that.
Yeah. But anyway, I don't think we're ever going to say that it's not worth reading one of the Discworld novels.
No, I wouldn't start with
him. No, I wouldn't start. But yeah, come back to this later. It's fine. It's all right. Anyway, we shall wrap this up. So we shall be back next time. And as we've alluded to, we shall be reading Weird Sisters, which comes usually very, very high on fan lists of best Discworld novels.
This is one of the entry points.
Entry points, which is, you know, very, very often. And, you know, it's a pretty good book. So, thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you for listening.
And we shall see you next time with Weird Sisters. Thank you for listening to Dining Table Discworld. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/diningtablediscworld. You can also find us on Blue Sky at DT Discworld. All our other contact information and credits for our music can be found in our show notes. Thank you for listening again, and we'll see you in our next episode.